Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 2, 2016. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Red River Métis. On this week's program, we mark the passing of El Comandante Fidel Castro Ruz with a special program reviewing his life and the achievements of the revolution he championed. The son of a wealthy landowner and veteran of the Spanish-American War of 1898, Fidel Castro, the fifth of nine children, benefited from a Jesuit education and eventually studied law at Havana University. During the late 1940s, he became politically engaged and active within the New Ortodoxos Party. By 1952, Fulgencio Batista seized power in a coup. Castro began to organize revolutionary activities and on July 26, 1953, launched an armed attack against the Moncada barracks in Santiago. The insurgency was put down and Castro was condemned to a 15-year prison sentence. Released after Batista announced a general amnesty of the prisoners, Castro sought exile in Mexico, where he met Argentine doctor Ernesto Che Guevara. In December of 1956, he and scores of men returned to Cuba in a yacht named the Granma, where they began a 22-month insurgency against Batista, which culminated in the dictator's departure from Havana on December 31, 1958. Castro arrived in Havana on January 8th of 1959 and assumed the role of prime minister in February of that year. He would remain Cuba's head of state for decades, outlasting 11 U.S. presidents. The newly independent country faced momentous challenges, most notably the threats coming from the United States. When efforts to co-opt the young leader proved unsuccessful, Washington, under newly minted President John F. Kennedy, attempted an invasion at the Bay of Pigs. The operation involved opposition forces working in conjunction with the CIA. The plot proved unsuccessful, damaging America's prestige and boosting the popularity of the new Cuban government, painting the revolution with a kind of David and Goliath mystique. A lengthy U.S. embargo would follow, combined with propaganda and even terrorist attacks directed at Cuba, with the assistance of the pro-Batista exile community in Miami, Florida. The USSR forged an alliance with Cuba. The Soviet leader, Khrushchev, authorized the cruise missiles with nuclear warheads be dispatched to the country for defensive purposes. The infamous cruise missile crisis resulted, in which a nuclear war was barely averted. Castro evolved into a symbol of defiance of U.S. imperial hegemony. His death on November 25th was greeted with great mourning and sadness from his countrymen and from downtrodden peoples around the world inspired by his example. However, mainstream media in the last week has been far from kind to the passing of this giant. To discuss the media response, I'm joined by fellow Canadian journalist Leslie Hughes. She's a broadcaster, media critic, speaker, and humorist. She joins us from her home in Winnipeg. Now, Prime Minister Trudeau issued a statement of condolence following Fidel Castro's death. What did you make of the response that he got from within the mainstream and social media?
Well, the statement itself was, it struck me as minimal. It really was just a courteous statement. And it was a big surprise to me to see that it was met with borderline hysteria. The response from the mainstream didn't surprise me quite as much, I think, as social media, because mainstream media has been manipulated by American opinion for decades, and so much so that we scarcely are aware of it. And the social media response was hysterical. You know what? It was almost a gotcha moment. You're familiar with gotcha journalism, which was a big surprise. It was very black and white response, a binary response to what Trudeau had said. And so what happened was that it became a dysfunctional story, and a dysfunctional story is what the journalism instructors define as a story that it doesn't really have a satisfactory shape or resolution. It just sort of hovers over the community being vaguely poisonous and then eventually wears itself out. So it was a, journalistically speaking, it was an interesting incident.
Could you maybe outline what you think a responsible news organization should be doing as they approach a story of this magnitude?
Well, you know, it just sounds so self-evident. It's a matter of avoiding opinion where it's not appropriate and establishing fact. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about being in a post-truth era, which largely is meant to apply to politicians. Feel they're living in a post-truth era, and the masses, I'm putting that in quotations, are in a post-truth era. But I'm afraid that the media, you know, sensing these things and having even isolated and identified it, are taking advantage of that. So that, you know, they're quite able to express opinion that is not backed by fact. So I'm not saying that, you know, it has to be one opinion or the other. Everybody's opinion needs to be respected, but it also needs to encompass the facts. And the tone here, you know, was one which lacked any balance. A lot of the media venues switched immediately to angry about human rights tone. And frequently, these are people who don't have much interest in human rights in any case, except in a situation like this. So that anyone who wants to do a critique of their opinion then becomes anti-human rights, and so it oppresses the argument. If you understand what I'm saying, so that the overall tone is one which discourages any real discussion. So in this case, the trick, I think, was for headlines from which so many people, cut lines and headlines, so many people get their opinions from those sources. And they needed to be very condensed, but they should have, I think, have said, this is what Castro achieved for Cuba, which is immense, by the way, in many cases, a society that is better than the United States. And this is where he failed, you know, and citing, of course, the sources where possible.
What would you recommend to those of our listeners who may be seeking a more accurate understanding of Castro's death within an important, that broader political context?
Well, the trick is always to try to see the story through the eyes of the people at the center of the story, rather than just the eyes of readers, listeners, viewers, and what happened, what have you. That's the trick, is to try to bring that perspective forward, which seems to me to be a pretty important one. In this case, you know, for millions of people around the world, in Central America, in South America, in Africa, and in India, there a totally different story emerges, because these people see Castro as a liberator. And they see him as a champion of independence, so that all the coverage that we get here is not sympathetic to the view of the people at the center of the story. And if you want to get that, you know, I'm sorry to say, the only way is by independent research. You have to look past the mainstream media. You have to disregard social media, which is, you know, as everyone knows, wholly irresponsible, and do research. And in my case, you know, what I have not experienced in person, I research, in this case, Castro by association, Castro and Mandela, who was a good friend of his, by the way, Castro and Martin Luther King, Castro and economics, Castro and feminism, and look up the topics that you that interest you, and then try to put the big picture together. It's a lot of work, Michael, and most people aren't willing to do it.
Well, I appreciate your insights, Leslie. I want to thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Michael. Anytime.
We've been speaking with Leslie Hughes, Winnipeg-based journalist, broadcaster, and media critic. Eva Golinger is an attorney with nearly two decades of experience in immigration law. She's been a high-level strategic consultant for high-level clients worldwide, including the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. She's the author of six books, including The Chavez Code and Bush vs. Chavez, Washington's War on Venezuela. She appears as a regular host on RT Spanish and has received awards for her writings and investigations, including the prestigious International Journalism Award in Mexico. Eva Golinger makes her debut on the Global Research News Hour to share some of her insights into Fidel Castro and how he shaped the destiny of Cuba and Latin America. Welcome to the program, Eva Golinger.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start with your personal impressions of the man? I understand you had a chance to meet El Comandante Castro back in 2005. How did that encounter inform your understanding of who he was and how he championed the national cause?
Well, after that, I actually interacted on numerous occasions with him, but certainly that was the first time. I could say that the first time I ever went to Cuba was in 1995. I was about 22 years old. I couldn't have imagined that 10 years later, I would be standing at the side of Fidel Castro and meeting him at 32 years old. Of age myself, but certainly it was a humbling experience. Just months before that specific encounter, I had launched my first book, The Chavez Code, which was the result of research I had done about the U.S.-led coup against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 2002. And the book was actually published as well in Cuba and launched there in the book fair, the International Book Fair, in early 2005. And to my surprise, after the day of the launch, when I went back to the place I was staying in Havana, I had received a giant bouquet of flowers and a bottle of perfume from Fidel. So that was sort of my first interaction with him that, you know, it was unbelievable for me that this man was so much history, so much legacy, such an overwhelming presence worldwide, loved, hated, revered, admired, you know, had sent me flowers because I had launched a book at, you know, the age of 32. And months later, I was back in Havana on a trip with Hugo Chavez. He had invited me to accompany him. We had become friends as well as, you know, I was advising him on certain matters. And it was one of the first actual gatherings of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. At that time, it just was Cuba and Venezuela were members. You know, it later grew to include 11 countries, now has, I think, around between 9 and 11 countries are formal members. But it was a meeting, you know, with these two very prominent, controversial world leaders. And I happened to be in the middle of it. And we walked through parts of Havana Vieja, old Havana, both of them, Fidel and Chavez, just walking through the streets. I mean, it was such an overwhelming and unbelievable experience because, you know, people often see leaders like that, heads of state, you know, controversial assassination threats against them and think, well, they never interact with the people. You know, they're characterized as dictators, as tyrants in a lot of Western media. But here we were strolling the streets of old Havana, waving to people, they're hugging, they're kissing, you know, I mean, as though just two guys and a bunch of other people, of course, around them walking through this beautiful part of the town.
That's virtually unheard of in so-called democracies, never mind.
Well, certainly. I mean, that level of interaction with the people, because we're not talking about anything that was, you know, prearranged in terms of who could interact with them. And of course, there was security. But Cuba is an incredibly safe place. Havana is the safest city I've ever been to in the world in my life. And I've been to a lot. And so it was an amazing experience. And then I had the chance to interact with Fidel. Chavez got a little envious, and I'm just saying that in a really humble way, but came over and in the middle of my conversation with Fidel, when he was talking to me about Luis Posada Carriles, Cuban terrorist who bombed a Cuban airliner in 1976 and has received protection by the U.S. And Venezuela was trying to get him extradited to Venezuela because that's where he had planned the bombing of the airliner. You know, it's a subject for another discussion. But in any case, that was the time. It was 2005, and the extradition request had just been put in. So Fidel wanted to talk to me about that. Me being someone from the United States and having knowledge of those matters, being an attorney, that's what he wanted to discuss. I mean, it was amazing. It wasn't just, you meet this world leader, you reach out, shake their hand, I give him a copy of my book, you have that kind of interaction. No, he wanted to have an in-depth discussion at an analytical level. What do you think about this? What do you think they're going to do? He wanted my opinion. He wanted to talk about it. And it was, it was a really interesting discussion. And at the same time, one is sort of looking at, who am I talking to here? This is Fidel Castro. This is this person that has just this enormous amount of history around him. And, being in that place at that time, it was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. In any case, it was an incredible experience to have gone through with Fidel particularly, but also, being there, Chavez and Fidel shared a very special relationship, and it was a very privileged experience to be in the presence of both of them at that time. And, then the years that followed, we maintained contact. We exchanged text, and he frequently commented on my writings in his reflections. He published a column, Fidel published a column of his reflections on different issues, and often referred to my work. And over the years, I got a few boxes of cigars here and there.
And I was wondering if I could maybe just maybe be a bit of a fly in the wall in some of those conversations, because I know you've done a lot of research in the context of Venezuela and efforts to undermine that government, and your research into some of these foreign policy instruments, USAID and USAID and National Endowment for Democracy and so on. And I'm wondering if you could share insights into the way these agencies operate and how Castro confronted those activities, and how they may provide some context for some of the things that have been said about him being, authoritarian and a dictator and whatnot.
Well, certainly from the time of the Cuban Revolution, even though in its beginning stages, Castro had the intention of maintaining a friendly relationship with the United States. Unfortunately, it wasn't the U.S. policy at the time, nor it has been since. And ever since then, the U.S. has been undergoing efforts of regime change in Cuba, and to the extreme where they've tried to assassinate Fidel Castro over 600 times that have been documented with solid evidence. And beyond that, all sorts of different tactics to undermine the Cuban Revolution, Cuba's political process, to infiltrate Cuban political organizations, to actually construct and build other organizations with the pretense of them being pro-democracy NGOs, when in reality they're funded by these U.S. agencies that in fact were created specifically to pursue those types of strategies with a sort of more acceptable facade as promoting democracy around the world. But the complete creation of National Endowment for Democracy, which is congressionally funded in the United States and overseen by the Department of State, as well as USAID, which was initially created with this humanitarian mission under Kennedy, but evolved rapidly to become yet another facade of and channel of U.S. interference in foreign nations using a pretext of humanitarian assistance. Not to say that sometimes work that USAID has done has not been positive for the countries they've worked in. Certainly there are some things that, one can look at and say, okay, that was obviously something legitimate. But the fact that they've increased actually their work efforts and budgets and strategies under their so-called democracy and governance and reconstruction and transition departments, which are all focused on regime change and then rebuilding, countries in the way that the United States wants them to be, including with governments that will be subordinate to U.S. interests, favorable to U.S. agenda. So over the decades, that's been ongoing in Cuba. Of course, Cuba and the Cuban Revolution took a very different tactic than we've seen in the 21st century in revolutions in Latin America and political transformation processes, such as in Venezuela or in Bolivia or Ecuador, where they've done it through democratic process. In the case of Cuba, you know, obviously there was the overthrowing of a dictatorship, of Batista, the Cuban Revolution took over initially with a plan of, you know, pursuing their form of democracy. It evolved into their own form of socialism, you know, with different elements of democracy. But one of the key differences is that because of the immense threats, because the fact that Cuba, such a small country, has no, at the time at least, did not have any capable armed forces that could, you know, come up against a country like the United States and its immense military power, doesn't have nuclear weapons or anything of the sort, missiles, like, you know, anything that could have engaged in a direct classic warfare with the United States. You know, Cuba had to basically shut down and say, you're out. We don't want to have any presence here of any disrupting force or element. And so the agencies that began working, like NED or USAID, had to do so outside of Cuba, whereas they've pursued those tactics inside countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and many others around the world. The difference with Cuba is that they formed a lot of the organizations that they fund through U.S. government agencies in the Cuban exile community in Miami. And so those were the ones that initially began the work. And then that evolved, you know, as there was entryway into Cuba physically, they began forming groups and funding, you know, anti-government activists actually on the island. And, you know, it got to the point where some of the documents, some has not been through my particular investigation, but others who do similar work, you know, who uncovered that silly text messaging program, Sunsunio, where the USAID funded with millions of dollars a program to try to influence young Cubans in Cuba through a text messaging service that, you know, drew them in through entertainment and sports, but then was injecting political messages in the hopes of building an anti-government movement that would overthrow the Castro government, you know, things like that. And that type of work has continued. And they've, you know, tried to do that through media. Of course, we know all about the media efforts to interfere in the island and project and transmit, you know, anti-Castro and anti-Cuban revolution propaganda. But, you know, some of that has increased throughout the past couple of decades, and more so in the past 15 years since there have been other changes in Latin America and the rise of other leftist governments, very pro-Cuba, and, you know, that have helped to sort of push forward and maintain the Cuban Revolution through difficult economic times. Certainly the U.S. government has continued injecting over $20 million a year through these agencies such as USAID and NED to try to continue to build anti-government groups inside Cuba and outside Cuba that are capable of interfering internally in the Cuban political process. Mm.
I know I've only got time for one more question because I know you got to go soon, but I wanted you to comment, if you could, on, like, there was a recent thawing in relations under Obama. However, President-elect Trump has threatened to reimpose sanctions, and you've heard the sorts of things he's had to say about him and his vice president, Mike Pence, calling him a tyrant and so on. So I just wanted to get your thoughts about what the death of Castro and the arrival of the Trump administration will mean for the future of Cuba.
Well, certainly the passing of Fidel Castro was to be expected, 90 years old. I mean, he went out victoriously because they tried to kill him so many times. You know, all the speculation around how Fidel Castro would exit from this planet officially was wrong. He proved them wrong at every stage. You know, they thought he'd rule forever till his death. You know, he stepped down voluntarily and throughout the years since has become more of sort of an intellectual presence, as well as always maintaining that sort of figurehead as the comandante of the Cuban Revolution. But in these past couple years since the thawing in relations between the two governments, U.S. and Cuba, as pursued by Raul Castro and Barack Obama, Fidel maintained his very accurate, and I agreed with, position of being cautious and wary of U.S. intentions. Because as positive as the steps were that Obama helped push forward inside the United States, and they certainly have been, and he's done pretty much as he could, considering the restraints in Congress, that they're the final entity that has to lift the blockade against Cuba. But Obama has done a lot of other stuff that's been very valuable for improving the relationship beyond just the diplomatic ties and the release of the remaining Cuban five. But, you know, we have to be realistic about this. Cuba has always been open to having a better relationship. They don't want another government coming in to tell them what to do. So that's the bottom line here. And if Trump is going to roll back everything Obama has done so far, which a lot of that he can do, he'll come up against a lot of opposition internally in the United States. Will that have any impact on Cuba? Absolutely not. I mean, it's, you know, this is the Cuban government, the Cuban Revolution has been battling U.S. aggression for over half a century. They know exactly what they're dealing with. They have no pretense of expecting anything from the United States. It's not as though they've opened up their doors and said, oh, come on in and do whatever you want. And now when Trump gets into office, which so we hope won't happen, but when he does, you know, and tries to do things, Cuba's not just going to sit there and let it happen. So, you know, they will take a more radical stance. A lot of people were deceived by Trump and fell trapped to his, he's a con man. And he sold, you know, to the people who voted for him, a whole idea that he was some kind of radical change maker, which is absolutely ridiculous. He's a con artist who's only in it for himself and the people who are going to keep him in power. That's all he's interested in. He's an extreme narcissist. And so it's all about him. And he knew that the people that would, only people who would really support him are the extremist neoconservatives of the Republican Party and beyond. And so they're the ones that have that kind of reactionary, you know, antiquated viewpoint on Cuba. So what will they do? What will he do? How much can he do? Well, that will be something to be seen and something to be, you know, debated over within the United States. How will it harm Cuba? Cuba will continue to protect themselves in the same ways and defend their revolution in the same way that they have for over half a century. And the same, and they will continue to have the support of all of Latin America and most of the entire planet who have always been against the U.S. blockade against Cuba and have always supported Cuba's right to sovereignty and have recognized Cuba's extraordinary capacity of solidarity around the world, of their technological development, and of their unbelievable determination and persistence and ability to overcome the most extreme and powerful obstacles to bring forward their country despite the immense difficulties they face. They're some of the most educated people in the world, the most politically conscious people in the world, you know, and people who strive to be a collective part of not just their own country, but of the entire planet, and see themselves in that way, despite being this tiny island of just 11 million people with basically no economy, you know, that in any way contributes to the rest of the world. They contribute in human resources, in being kind and generous citizens of the world. And Cuba will continue to do that. And I think that those of us who have, you know, supported them and will continue to, will stand up in the face of any further aggression coming from the U.S. or elsewhere against Cuba.
Eva Gollinger, I want to thank you so much for making yourself available to share your unique perspective on this unique turning point in history. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Eva Gollinger is an attorney and media personality and an award-winning journalist and author. She joined us from New York. Her website is evagollinger.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Our podcasts can be found on the website globalresearch.ca. One of the understated achievements of Fidel Castro in the Cuban Revolution was the level of solidarity expressed for other liberation struggles, not just in Latin America, but in Africa, Asia, and even black populations within the United States. The affection for Castro was not merely inspired by its example in hiving off Cuba from U.S. imperial interests. Over the decades, Cubans have been actively involved abroad, exporting doctors, teachers, and troops, even at the cost of their own national security. To tell us more about the significance of Cuba's foreign engagements, we're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He's a geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire. Many of his essays are posted at the Global Research website. Thank you once again for joining us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, I can see where the charismatic Castro would inspire liberation struggles abroad just by the success of his liberation of Cuba from the U.S. and its local proxies. How big a factor was his solidarity actions abroad in cementing his appeal to the world's struggling peoples?
I think it was enormous. First of all, Cuba is by and large an African nation. Many of the people who reside there are of African descent. The culture is heavily dominated by African cultural retentions. They overthrew slavery. Slavery ended in Cuba much later than it ended in the United States, some two decades or more later. So they had to overcome a tremendous legacy of racism and national oppression. In regard to the 1959 revolution, it outlawed institutional racism and discrimination. This was a clear signal to the United States, where in 1959, Jim Crow was still the law of the land, not only in the South, but also many areas in the North and the West, outside of the former antebellum states. So that in and of itself was an internationalist statement being made by the Cuban Revolution towards the peoples of the world. Then, of course, if we look at the early phase of the Cuban Revolution in 1960 and 1961, we had the U.S.-backed interference in the internal independence process in the Belgian Congo. And Cuba was very much in solidarity with the Lumumba's forces. Che Guevara spoke out very strongly against the plot and also the execution of Patrice Lumumba. And then in later on in 1965, Cuba was involved in an internationalist mission in Congo that lasted for several months. Although it was not successful, it laid the groundwork for deeper involvement in other African states, particularly Angola, in 1975. But one often not recognized or known about was Cuba's involvement in defending the Algerian Revolution in 1963, when Algeria was invaded by Morocco at the aegis of the United States, and Cuba actually came to the military and political defense of the newly liberated Algerian government under Ben Bella. So these are just some of the early recollections in regard to Cuba and its internationalist impact on Africa, as well as Africans and other oppressed people throughout the world.
Now, I know that you just mentioned, when you mentioned Angola, I mean, that does strike me as being a particularly significant event, and especially when you consider the what started out in the mid-70s and then extended right through the 80s. There was eventually that battle, very decisive battle of Quito Quanival, in which the South African apartheid forces got a major, it was a major defeat. And that certainly, there was a sense there of like the enormous number of Cubans who were dispatched to that, involved in that effort. And it clearly did inspire the affections of, well, Nelson Mandela, among others. I wonder if you might just want to give us a little bit more of an understanding of that significance, not just locally, but even on an international level.
It was very important. The relationship between the Cuban government, the Cuban Communist Party, even before the Cuban Communist Party was formed in 1965, there was a close relationship between the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, the MPLA, was headed by Augustino Neto and Fidel Castro and the Cuban government, going back to the early 1960s. So in 1975, when the Angolan independence was threatened on two fronts, the FNLA, the Front, National Front for the Liberation of Angola, headed by Holden Roberto, was supported by the United States Central Intelligence Agency and the Mobutu government and the then Zaire, invaded from the north, heading towards the capital in an effort to seize control of the independence process. And you had the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, UNITA, which was based in the central and southern part of the country, close to the border with Namibia. You also had the intervention of the South African Defense Forces, and Cuba intervened in 1975, October, November, eventually sending in 55,000 troops and other personnel to defend the MPLA, consolidating their role in the independence process and beating back the South African Defense Forces, UNITA, as well as the FNLA. And that international solidarity continued for another 14 years. There were many battles that were fought over that time period. Came to a head in late 1987 and the early months of 1988, where at the small village of Puerto Carnaval, there was a decisive battle which convinced the South African Defense Forces that they can no longer continue to occupy Angola, and that they had to negotiate a independence process for Namibia, which was done, and an agreement was reached in 1988. The process started in 89, and Namibia held elections in November of 1989 and gained their independence on March 21st of 1990. And this, of course, also influenced the unbanning of the ANC, the African National Congress, in early February of 1990, and then Nelson Mandela in February 11th of 1990, which started the negotiation process for the transition from apartheid to the first non-racial democracy in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there's, of course, there's been the extensive exportation of doctors and teachers around, and even engineers, to all these various different parts of the world, Haiti, and even most recently, fought the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. And so, is there a way of qualifying the impact that having those medical and other social sector ambassadors going abroad has made in the world, on the world stage?
It's been a tremendous benefit to people in Venezuela, for example, and other countries in South America. Also on the African continent, they have deployed healthcare personnel in various geopolitical regions. The fight against the Ebola virus disease, Cuba played a very, very spectacular role in that entire process, to the point where even the United States, this is prior to the process of, quote, normalization, unquote, they had to recognize the contributions that Cuba made to the entire process of national liberation.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's within the Latin America, you had with Castro, and then the rise of Chavez and Morales, and that whole sense of a regional resistance to U.S. hegemonic domination.
So
you maybe just speak to that that catalytic role that Castro played in making all that happen. I mean, could it? Is it even conceivable that could have happened without Castro and the example and involvement that he set?
No, it could not have, or it would have been much more difficult. As early as 1959, Fidel and the Cuban revolutionaries appealed for Latin American solidarity. At that time, it was not feasible on a governmental level, although there was tremendous support on a grassroots level for the Cuban Revolution, as evidenced by the response, popular response, in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion in early 1961. But since the late 1990s, with the Bolivarian Republic coming into being and Hugo Chavez becoming another major charismatic political figure throughout the region, this was accelerated with ALBA, with Mercosur and other interstate alliances, and also in terms of getting Cuba, breaking the isolation that the U.S. imperialists had imposed on Cuba through the Organization of American States. Now there are alternative structures that are much more beneficial to the people of the region. Also, there's been an escalation in regional solidarity between South America and the African continent. You have the Africa-South America Summit, which has held four meetings. The last one, of course, was in Equatorial Guinea. Chavez was not able to attend. He sent a statement of solidarity. Prior to that, there was a meeting on Margarita Island in off the coast of Venezuela. So not only has it been a had a very positive impact on Latin American solidarity within South America and the Central America and other areas, it's also fostered international solidarity with Africa, Cuban involvement in the non-aligned movement, and other international institutions.
He spent that very special time in 1960 at the Teresa Hotel in Harlem, where he met with Malcolm X and Langston Hughes and other figures. And so he's been influential within the United States. And I'm wondering if you could trace that, you know, what that ongoing legacy, that influence for liberation struggles within the heart of the empire.
Yes, after the consolidation of the revolution in 1959, several months later, Castro visited the United States. Toured, he spoke at the Harvard Law School. He wanted to have a meeting with the then president, Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower refused to speak with him. And then he met with Richard Nixon, who later wrote a memo saying that Castro was a communist and he should be overthrown. When he came back the following year in 1960, he was treated with extreme discourteousness and was literally forced out of the hotels in lower and midtown Manhattan, and wound up, as you mentioned, at the Teresa Hotel, which is still there now on 125th Street in Harlem, and was greeted there by leading figures, including Nikita Khrushchev, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, also Malcolm X, who later became El Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. And, of course, this showed that Castro had a tremendous status among people internationally as well as among African-Americans in the United States.
So I'm just wondering now if you could say in maybe 30 seconds or so, what does his absence mean for the future of these liberation struggles?
Well, his legacy lives on. Cuba is there. We saw over the last few days the millions who came out to honor his legacy, and also the medical program for African-Americans, Latinos inside the United States has trained hundreds of physicians from oppressed communities here in this country. There have been at least six physicians trained from the city of Detroit in Cuba in the Latin American School of Medicine. So that is going to ensure his immortality in regard to his concrete solidarity to oppressed peoples throughout the world, even inside the imperialist countries itself.
Abayomi Azikiwe, I want to thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on this special episode of the Gold Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me.
We've been joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He is a geopolitical analyst and editor of Pan-African Newswire, and many of his essays appear regularly on the Global Research website. collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union that followed took a huge toll on Cuba. In 1991, then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev announced it would end its $4 to $5 billion annual subsidy to the island nation. Overnight, Cuba lost over 50% of its oil imports and 85% of its trade economy. According to an Oxfam report cited by permaculture activist Megan Quinn Bachman, buses stopped running, generators stopped producing electricity, factories became silent as graveyards. Obtaining enough food for the day became the primary activity for many, if not most, Cubans. Nevertheless, the Cuban people endured and thrived in the face of these challenges. To tell us more about how Cubans under Castro confronted the crisis, we're joined once again by Richard Heinberg. He's the author of 13 books and scores of articles on the topic of depletion and sustainability. He is senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and is regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He joins us from his home in Santa Rosa, California. Thank you for joining us, Richard.
Yeah, good to be talking with you, Michael.
Richard, I've already outlined some of the dynamics of what Cubans were suddenly confronted with after the Soviet collapse. What were the key changes the government implemented that helped Cuba survive the storm?
Well, those changes largely had to do with the agricultural system and the transportation system, because both were heavily dependent on oil at the time of the Soviet collapse. Because Cuba had access to oil at below standard international oil prices, this was a way that the USSR was subsidizing the Cuban economy. Cuba was actually re-exporting oil, and that was its second foremost export prior to 1989. Because it was so dependent on oil for agriculture and transportation, This was a major challenge to the very existence of the country. So immediately, the fuel for tractors became scarce, fertilizers became scarce, pesticides became scarce, fuel for automobiles. There were a lot of personal automobiles at the time. But the government took steps to curtail personal automobile use and to supply more public transportation. But of course, there weren't enough buses to carry everyone. So people often had to wait hours for a bus. And over time, there had to be structural changes to the economy and to agriculture, relocalizing agriculture, because it wasn't any longer possible to move food around the country from the countryside to the cities in the quantities that had been transported. It wasn't any longer possible to operate the tractors, so those had to be replaced in many cases by animal power. Without the pesticides and herbicides, it was necessary to move to more organic forms of agriculture. And there was help for the Cuban people from outside. There were permaculturalists from Australia and other countries who traveled to Cuba to teach Cuban farmers how to grow food most effectively without fossil fuel inputs. But it was a big transition, and there were prices to be paid. The average Cuban lost something like 20 pounds of body weight, and this particularly affected the very young and the very old. There was malnutrition. Almost no one actually starved to death, but it was a toll on many members of the population. On the other hand, levels of certain diseases associated with the Western industrial agricultural diet actually went into decline. Heart disease, diabetes, stroke, all of those actually diabetes incidence actually decreased by half, and heart disease by a third. So it was complex. You know, you can't really say it was a blessing to the country, because there was a lot of suffering. But on the other hand, many of the adaptations to what became called the special period were actually beneficial, and the government was very proud of them, and many of the people actually approved of some of these measures.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about some of the challenges, though. I mean, the among the adaptive mechanisms, as it seemed a loosening of state control. You know, state-owned lands, as you say, going down to being relocalized to local farmers and cooperatives. And I think that does strike me as being kind of the opposite of what one might expect in a crisis, especially in a society that's you're portrayed as authoritarian.
Right.
I'm wondering if most other societies would have undertaken the same or similar measures, or if there was like a unique characteristic about Cuban society and the Cuban people that might have enabled these measures to go forward.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. Cuba, in a way, is kind of a unique social experiment, and it's a very authoritarian country, but at the same time, there is a great sense of mutual cooperation and even mutual sacrifice for a greater cause. So, the state-owned farms that had existed, huge state-owned farms, were broken up. They were extremely inefficient, and you could say that the breaking up of the big state farms was necessary, in fact, in order for the country and the economy to survive. Cuba had been a big exporter of sugar from sugarcane, and this was not an efficient crop to grow, either from an economic standpoint or from the standpoint of nourishing the Cuban people. So very quickly, sugar cane cultivation was set aside in favor of growing fruit and vegetables. So, you know, the government, I think, had some good advice from not only from domestically from agronomists in the universities in Cuba, but also from foreigners who came to help during the special period. And I think it's to the credit of the Cuban government that this good advice was taken to heart.
Mm. Now, this is, you said that, talked about structural changes, and I thought of, you know, structural adjustment programs, and, you know, like, I this is a model of agrarian reform that's quite different from what you'd expect from the IMF or the World
Right.
Bank. Do you see any evidence that the Cuban model is finding a foothold in other parts of the world?
Not so much. I mean, really, the Cuban special period was a result not just of sort of generic economic collapse, but very specifically a result of oil, petroleum, being removed from the industrial system in a very rapid, almost catastrophic way. I think part of the reason that the Cuban example is relevant is because this is something that could happen to many other countries in foreseeable ways. I mean, we have a global petroleum market that could foreseeably be disrupted profoundly as a result of war, economic circumstances, even simple depletion over time. And so in the Cuban instance, we see one example of how societies could be forced to adapt to an oil depletion or oil interruption crisis. And I think despite the fact that there was a lot of suffering in Cuba, it's in many ways a good example, an instructive example of what could be done.
Okay. Well, that certainly sounds like it has the potential to be a great Cuban export if the world is willing to listen and make some sense of that surviving that that crisis. Richard Heinberg, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's always a pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks. Richard Heinberg is senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of a number of books on fossil fuel depletion and transition, including his most recent Our Renewable Future, published in June 2016. He publishes a monthly newsletter at the website www.richardheinberg.com. Before we close this week's program, I wanted to direct listeners' attention to conversations conducted with Fidel Castro by Global Research founder and editor Michel Chalsadovsky. These talks took place in Havana during a three-day visit in October of 2010. They were transcribed, translated from Spanish, and printed in Professor Chalsadovsky's 2015 book, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. In an introduction to the conversations from November of 2010, Chalsadovsky explains that the focus of the discussion was on the dangers of a nuclear war. He states, quote, "In this broad exchange of ideas, Fidel was invariably assertive in his views, but at the same time respectful of those whom he condemned or criticized, particularly when discussing U.S. presidential politics. Fidel is acutely aware of the mechanisms of media disinformation and war propaganda and how they are used to undermine civil rights and social progress, not to mention the smear campaign directed against the Cuban Revolution." A central concept put forth by Fidel Castro in our discussions was the battle of ideas. The leader of the Cuban Revolution believes that only a far-reaching battle of ideas can change the course of world history. In addressing and understanding this worldwide crisis, commitment to the truth and analysis of the lies and fabrications which sustain the corporate and financial elites is of utmost importance, unquote. The conversations can be found by visiting the website globalresearch.ca and by clicking the feature article, Fidel Castro Ruse, His Legacy Will Live Forever, from November 26, 2016. Music this week was provided by Silvio Rodriguez and Carlos Puebla. The Global Research News Hour will be back next week. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch. We'll close this week's conversation on Castro and his legacy with a speech given by Fidel Castro Ruse from October 15, 2010, recorded and translated by Professor Chalsadovsky and recited by myself. There would be collateral damage, as the American political and military leaders always affirm, to justify the deaths of innocent people. In a nuclear war, the collateral damage would be the life of all humanity. Let us have the courage to proclaim that all nuclear or conventional weapons, everything that is used to make war, must disappear. The battle of ideas consists in confronting the war criminals in high office, breaking the U.S.-led consensus in favor of a global war, changing the mindset of hundreds of millions of people, and abolishing nuclear weapons. In essence, the battle of ideas consists in restoring the truth and establishing the foundations of world peace. The conventional war would be lost by the U.S., and the nuclear war is no alternative for anyone. On the other hand, nuclear war would inevitably become global. I think nobody on Earth wishes the human species to disappear, and that is the reason why I am of the opinion that what should disappear are not just nuclear weapons, but also conventional weapons. We must provide a guarantee for peace to all peoples without distinction. In a nuclear war, the collateral damage would be the life of humankind. Let us have the courage to proclaim that all nuclear or conventional weapons, everything that is used to make war, must disappear. It is about demanding that the world is not led into a nuclear catastrophe. It is to preserve life.
El día primero aquel, lleno de emoción y ruido. Alguien dijo conmovido y feliz, gracias Fidel.
Y el pueblo después de un año repite, gracias Fidel.
Y el pueblo después de un año repite, gracias Fidel.